Senate Judiciary Budget Division meeting will come to order. Today is Tuesday, April 29th, 2008. And I welcome you. And first order of business is Senator Higgins and House File 2996 and Senate File 2790.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of background. When the conference committee for the budget fixing bill, House File 1812, had the policy provisions removed, the House turned House File 2996 into their kind of omnibus crime prevention bill. So this Senate file will become the companion. Oh, thank you. Kind of omnibus bill. Mr. Chair, when we were last in the Public Safety Budget Division, we worked on Senate File 2790, and this bill was the recommendations of the reentry working group that met many times last interim. And the working group had a lot of recommendations for the legislature, and then we got the fiscal note. And so the bill was pared down significantly to those things that we could afford. One of the pieces that everybody in the working group and I think most of the Public Safety Budget Division liked but the provision at that point wasn't ready for prime time was a provision that would enact a certificate of good conduct, like a certificate of rehabilitation, as it's called in other states, say that if a person has come out of prison and after a certain number of years has had no new violations, has a job, has gotten connected back with the community, and is well on his road to being a good citizen, his the generic term, then we can help out by issuing this certificate of good conduct, which then could be used for housing and employment and licensing issues. And what we know from what we've learned about a lot of studies and firsthand experience from people who've talked to us is that, you know, having that felony on their record really makes it difficult for people to find a good job and find housing. And so the working group really felt strongly about this. So we deleted it out of this bill in the Public Safety Budget Division, but I said at the time that if we could figure out how to pay for it and get some of the loose ends worked out, I would ask that it be put back in the next committee, which is here. So in the meantime, then, we said that, or I already told you that the House has turned this bill into kind of their omnibus crime prevention bill. So I have some provisions that are in an A1 amendment, including it's a delete-all, so it has the provisions that were adopted in the Public Safety Budget Division, as well as the Certificate of Good Conduct language, as well as some other provisions that at least one of them is Senator Foley's bill that came out of the budget-fixing bill and some other things. So, Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A1 amendment, and I think everybody has it at their desk or at their chair.
I wanted to interrupt because I didn't indicate that there was a quorum, so we do have a quorum.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And Senator Higgins has the A1 amendment.
And, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of oral amendments, if Mr. Backus can help with those, please.
Do we have the A1 amendment?
It's in your pile of paper there, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, also, there should be a detailed section-by-section summary of the A1 amendment as well. And as Senator Higgins mentioned, a good portion of the A1 amendment is actually from the bill before you, Senator Higgins' bill, as it came out of her division. And then we have to do a delete everything amendment because we're dealing with the House file. So a lot of it is ready before you, and then the rest of it are the new stuff that she mentioned. I believe, Senator Higgins, that you said that you wanted to delete Section 2 of the A1 amendment, which was Senator Moi's provision, which she put on the omnibus transportation bill yesterday.
That's right, and I think that, you know, we don't need to duplicate it here. So, Mr. Chair, I'd move that we delete Section 2, starting on the bottom of page 1.
And then, Mr. Chair, there's one more very, very minor amendment, but if you turn to page 14, line 23, there's a quotation mark there. If you delete the quotation mark and then on line 24 after the period, after the second period, insert it there, that would be good.
Would you repeat that, please?
Mr. Chair, on page 14, line 23, delete the quotation mark, and then on line 24, after the second period, after 2008, reinsert the quotation mark.
Mr. Heard Chair, that? I'll incorporate that in the A1 amendment, please. Do we want to adopt the amendment first, and then we can walk through it and make amendments and have discussions, Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins moves the bill. Pardon? A1 amendment. As amended. All those in favor indicate by aye.
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 Contrary, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, let's see. Section 1, we've talked about, I think everybody's been in the room and we've been discussing. We're deleting an expiration date on internet access at the BCA. That's just a simple deletion of the expiration date. We deleted Section 2. Section 3 would have the Department of Corrections develop a marketing plan to deal with MnCOR, and then we say that it needs to be reviewed and updated each year. And I think as, you know, budgets get tighter and tighter, the work that MnCOR does is going to be increasingly important, I think, to the residents as well as the Department of Corrections. Section 4 starts the discussion on the certificates of good conduct. We say in Section 4, Subdivision 3, that sufficient evidence of rehabilitation may be established by the production of a certificate. That's a hard word to say. Certificate of good conduct for the purpose of public for the purpose of public employment or occupational licensure. Section 5 provides exceptions to what the certificate can be used for, and it states that they do not apply for the licensing process for peace officers and firefighters, for juvenile corrections employment for certain underlying crimes, for school districts, and for practicing medicine. Section 6 is the process of petitioning for the certificate. It kind of just walks us through how it would be done, what the petition would include, the petitioner's full name and all the other legal names that he or she might have used, date of birth, addresses, why the certificate is being sought and why it should be granted, kind of a statement of purpose, and the details of the offense or the offenses for which the certificate is being sought, names of the victims, and then I think very importantly is item number 6, what steps the petitioner has taken since the time of the offense toward personal rehabilitation, including treatment, work, and other personal history that demonstrates the rehabilitation. Number 7 talks about spelling out in the petition the person's criminal conviction record for misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and felonies in Minnesota as well as every other jurisdiction, state, federal, and foreign country. And you can walk through it as well. If there's an order for protection or if there's a restraining order against the person or a no-contact order, those kinds of things, that all has to be stated in the petition. Subdivision 3 spells out how the petition is served and the petitioner mails the petition to the prosecutor's office that had jurisdiction over the offense. The prosecutor's office then sends it on its way to other folks, as spelled out in B there. And item C then specifically says that the victims of the offense have to be notified and are informed that they are allowed to submit either oral or written testimony at the hearing. Subdivision 4 spells out the details of the hearing. It says, if possible, the sentencing judge should preside over the hearing. And once again, it states that the victim has a right to submit testimony, either written or oral.
Sarah Higgins, mm-hmm. Who would hear that if the sentencing judge didn't? In Hennepin, you might have a referee or something, it seems to me. That
I would defer to Mr. Backus for help with that.
Mr. Chair, I think it's structured so that it would be essentially a judge hearing it if a county has some other system where they allow someone else to make these type of determinations. I suppose they'd be able to do that, but the language does say judge.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, Hennepin County referees do not hear criminal cases. They're specialty courts like family court, probate, juvenile court, but not criminal court.
All right. Senator Higgins.
Okay. Subdivision 5 on the bottom of page 5 tells what people are eligible for the Certificate of Good Conduct. They are people who have been successfully discharged from the sentence imposed and not under correctional supervision for any other offense as well, not required to register as a predatory offender, has been law-abiding for three years for most people, 5 years if the person was required to register as a predatory offender. Once again, the person demonstrates rehabilitation shown, among other ways, by evidence of the person's good character, employment, volunteer activities, participation in vocational, educational, treatment, or rehab programs. The person has to have paid any court-ordered fines or restitution or any costs related to a crime that have been imposed. If the crime was alcohol or drug-related, the person has to show he's not abusing or using alcohol or the controlled substance. And then any other factor that is relevant. Subdivision 6 talks about the judge shall issue a certificate if the petitioner establishes by a preponderance of the evidence that the petitioner meets the eligibility requirements. That's a high standard. Is that right? No? Sounds high to me. It's the lower standard. Okay, sorry. And then after filing the petition, the court shall notify the BCA. Subdivision 8 talks about the effect of the certificate, and it's...
Senator Higgins, did you have any indication that I have missed that shows the life of the certificate? So is this renewed periodically, or what happens?
Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and members, no. It would be permanent, except on subdivision 9, it's revoked by operational law if the person is subsequently convicted or adjudicated delinquent for a new crime.
Senator Higgins.
The effect of the certificate is that it creates a presumption of rehabilitation in favor of the person to whom it's issued and relieves the person of any state-imposed collateral sanction as defined, as it says there in 6.25 and 2.6. The certificate has no effect on collateral sanctions that are unrelated to housing, employment, or licensing. The bill then talks about the housing or licensing authority or employer may take into account, but is not required to take into account, a conviction that is the subject of the certificate of good conduct when making a housing, licensing, or hiring decision. Paragraph D says that the housing or licensing authority or the employer is not civilly or criminally liable for relying on the certificate of good conduct. Paragraph E says that evidence relating to a conviction for which the certificate has been issued is inadmissible in a civil action against a housing or licensing authority or employer for negligent or other fault in renting, leasing, licensing, or hiring if the authority or employer relied on the certificate when making their underlying decision. Subdivision 9, Mr. Back has talked about, it is revoked if the person subsequently is convicted or adjudicated delinquent of a new crime. Subdivision 10 specifically says that the certificate does not act as a pardon or an expungement. It doesn't relieve the person to whom it was issued of any collateral sanctions or legal disabilities related to predatory offender registration, eligibility to possess firearms, or a driver's license sanctions. And Subdivision 11 says that if the person knowingly uses or attempts to use a revoked certificate or fraudulently alters or forges a certificate, it is a misdemeanor. So that's the bulk of the certificate language, although there's some more scattered here and there.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Higgins, if you back up to page 6 there. Mm-hmm. I just have one question on the abusing alcohol or using controlled substance. Is there some kind of a standard that's going to be required? I mean, what kind of a form are we going to use or what require or do you have any idea? Successfully complete something maybe or?
Senator Hagan.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the way I think about it is if they were convicted of a drug crime or like drinking and driving sort of thing, you know, they have to show that they're, you know, maybe by being in AA or whatever, you know, something that shows that they are on their way to, or, you know, going through treatment or something on that line. Mr. Chair, Section 7 is a bill that we heard from Senator Moi spelling out that private employers should not use non-conviction records for hiring purposes. And I think all of us were in the committee when we discussed that before, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on that. Section 8 is Senator Foley's provision that was in the Senate budget-fixing bill, saying that the judicial branch may charge a small convenience fee for when people pay by electronic means. Section 9 is a provision, a very pared-down provision from my original bill, dealing with veterans or current military folks who get in trouble with the law. And as a result of a lot of conversations, a many-page bill got pared down to these three paragraphs, or I guess it's four paragraphs, but saying that when a defendant is convicted of a crime, the court shall inquire whether a defendant is active duty or a veteran. And then getting them some treatment through the military with a qualified psychiatrist or psychologist. And there are lots of people here in the room who can talk more about this, but this was something that we've worked with the Department of Veterans Affairs and a lot of other folks who are really worried about the small number of people who get in trouble with the law and have some underlying problems that may be related to their military service. And we can have more people talk about this if you would like, Mr. Chair. The next section, Section 10, says that, goes back to the Certificate of Good Conduct, and it says that if you have filed for an expungement or a certificate of good conduct within the past 2 years, you can't file for another one until at least 2 years has gone by. Section 11 is further clarification on the contents of the petition. Section 12 amends the victim notification statute by requiring that the notice be provided to victims when an offender seeks a certificate of good conduct. Section 13 was brought to us by the Board of Public Defense last year in our division bill. We put in the language from 11.27 to 11.33 requiring that the public defenders hire a whole lot of new time or full-time equivalents to address caseload increases, and it's pretty likely that we will cut their budget this year, so we probably shouldn't require them to hire all those people that they won't have money to hire. So that's where that came from. Section 14 would have the Commissioner of Corrections perform an internal review of the department's guidelines for revocation of parole and supervised release. And at a minimum, that review would assess the appropriateness and proportionality of the sanctions and the use of intermediate sanctions and the potential for expanding the use and number of intermediate sanctions and the option of capping the number of days that an offender can be reincarcerated. Section 15 is a working group on controlled substance laws. If you will remember, last year we asked the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to look at the controlled substance laws, and they did that, but they weren't really willing to give us any recommendations, and so we would now put a working group together, and you can see all the people that we are going to ask to be part of that working group and what the charge for that group would be is on page 13 and the top of page 14. We then would have them report back to us by January 15 of next year. Section 16 is an appropriations. The certificate of good conduct comes with a fee of, I think, $240. And when we first got a fiscal note, we had the courts and the Commissioner of Public Safety who had... had costs attached to that. So we bring in the fees through this bill, and then we appropriate the money to the courts and to the Department of Public Safety. And that, Master Chair, is that. And Mr. Backus can probably explain that way better than I did. Thank you.
Is there any member interested in asking questions from Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, there are some provisions that I probably didn't talk about well enough that Mr. Backus could give detail about. If
Mr. Chair, members, just quickly, Senator Higgins did cover most everything. Just so that for full disclosure, so to speak, the Certificate of Good Conduct, Section 6 on page 4, there were a few changes to that from the version that passed out of all the policy committees, and I just want to highlight them. Some of them were changed in the hopes of reducing fiscal costs, and one's more of a policy change. To begin with, language was deleted from the original provision that talked about the filing fee being able to be waived for indigency. So the provision is silent on the waiver issue right now. Another thing that was changed, and Senator Higgins alluded to it, is what we call the either-or situation, where you basically have a choice now to either file for a certificate of good conduct or file for an expungement within a 2-year period. You basically have to pick one or the other. Another change is that there was a sentence requiring that the hearing on the good certificate of good conduct be heard within 60 days. That was deleted by request of the courts to allow them to, if they couldn't meet that requirement. There was also a sentence deleted that authorized the parties to call witnesses to establish or refute eligibility for the certificate. That was deleted because it would expand the hearing into something more of a contested hearing that wasn't originally envisioned. The other change related to the certificate of good conduct is On page 6, basically the new sentence on line 27 through 33, I think there are two new sentences added that clarifies the extent, the effect of a certificate when it applies to DHS background checks. And that's consistent with the original intent of the legislation, but there was a thought that it needed to be made more explicit. And then on section 7, which is Senator Moi's provision on the use of non-conviction records, on lines 1 and 2, there's some new language added that begins with state that deal with stays of adjudication under 152.18 and referrals for diversion program. That was added, and it limits what is considered a non-conviction criminal record. So it basically limits the scope of the provision a little bit, and that was requested by Senator Moi. Section 8, Senator Foley's provision on convenience fees for courts, I just wanted to highlight that the paragraph C, which dealt with the records, was altered a little bit. And I talked to Ms. Pontius, who does the data practices here. The original provision said that the access to these records would be governed by the rules of the courts, essentially. And Senator Betzold had asked, would that be accessible to the public? And the answer was no. So I think we tried to clarify that basically that's not accessible to the general public. I don't think that's a real substantive change, but if the courts feel so, we can certainly talk about it. And then the Section 9, which deals with Senator Higgins' provision on post-traumatic stress military veterans, there's a clarification added that just requires that the defendant – it only applies that the defendant actually appears in court. It wouldn't apply to defenders who plead guilty by mail for traffic tickets. So the courts wanted to clarify that, so they wouldn't have any responsibility to do that in that cases. And Mr. Chair, that's basically it, because you Senator Higgins highlighted all the other new sections.
Senator Higgins, on the certificate of good conduct, is that a document that's likely to have a picture on it and so forth?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we've had any discussions about whether there would be a picture on it. Mr. Backus, do you remember any?
Mr. Chair and members, no, I don't recall any discussion about it, and the provision does not require a photograph. And I would imagine that there might be a fiscal issue with that, but it does not require that.
But over a long haul, it might be something that might be appropriate. Make sure you got the right person. Senator Limmer.
On page 8, we make reference to a convenience fee. I believe that's a new fee. And is there a definition in your bill of rights? What it could be specifically used for.
Mr. Backus.
Senator Higgins.
This wasn't my provision.
Mr. Chair and Senator Liberman, no, there's no definition of convenience fee. I'm sure the courts could discuss it, but this provision is already in the Senate's version of its omnibus bill, so it already passed the Senate, and it basically gives courts the same authority to charge fees, these credit card fees that the executive branch already has. And I'm sure, again, the courts could give you more information if you'd like.
So a convenience fee, Mr. Chair, is the fee that is added or a cost for the use of a credit card for making payment.
Mr. Chair, it's for using paying by electronic means. So if you can pay through, I don't know, do they use PayPal or something like that? And then the courts could add a small fee on there as well for that convenience.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I know how creative a court could be during a time when they may be short a few bucks, and I'm just thinking that maybe we need to put more of a definition specifically outlining the convenience fee as a cost of transaction via electronic means for the purposes of this section. The courts would be in agreement with that, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. In response to Senator Limmer, to the best of my knowledge, the definition of a convenience fee is already in statute. It's in the executive. It's in a different chapter that doesn't apply to the courts, and we just copied the language there. It is defined as the actual cost that the credit card company charges you for using that. So, for instance, right now the DNR charges $350. So it's not that we could ever charge people more than what is negotiated with credit card companies.
Ms. Chair and Senator Higgins, would you object if we made a reference to that definition in your bill? And that way, convenience fee per statute number and whatever it is. That way, we can keep a definition to what the convenience fee actually is for this purpose.
Where do you propose to put this?
Well, I would probably put it somewhere on the first mention of convenience fee, which would be page 8, line 34. A convenience fee, according to state statute, whatever it is, according to the definition found, and that way we could pin this down a little bit more specific.
Mr. Bacchus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, maybe if you could go on to other things, and we'll try to draft something. We have to get the exact statute.
Not sure that. Did you have more that you wanted to include on that, Ms. Marshall? Further questions, comments?
If not, Mr. Chair, I'll move that. Oh, yeah, that's right. We've got to figure that. So procedurally, do we take up the House file and put my language on it now, or is that done somewhere else along the line?
We already have the House file. It is about the House file.
Mm-hmm. It is a House file. We amend the House file. Okay.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak on this issue? Not the Vista card or any of those, but on the overall bill. If you do, would you come up to the far end there and tell us who you are?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the division. My name is Mark Hazy. I'm with the Council on Crime and Justice. And I'm a little new to the job, and I have to apologize especially to Senator Higgins because I just saw something in this certificate of rehabilitation bill that causes me some concern. It's on page 10 at the top, so it's paragraph B of section 10, subdivision 1. A person is not eligible for an expungement and may not file a petition under this chapter if the person has filed a petition for an expungement or a certificate of good conduct under sections 364.19 in the past 2 years. I can understand the logic behind this, and it would normally make sense that somebody couldn't, we don't want the courts and we don't want people filing these petitions over and over to see what happens. The problem with this currently is on May 6th, the Minnesota Supreme Court is going to hear a case to determine whether or not judges can expunge or seal records in the executive branch. There's been, I guess I would say, a little confusion at the Court of Appeals around this. And so what's been happening is some people have been petitioning for expungements. They've received an expungement, but only their court records have been sealed so that they still have this BCA record, which is where most employers and housing people get, or one of the places where records are located. So my fear with this provision is that if somebody recently or in the next until this becomes law files for an expungement, gets the expungement just for court records, but then the Supreme Court says that, well, actually judges can seal BCA records, those people who actually got an expungement but just didn't have the BCA record sealed are going to have to wait 2 years to refile to get the BCA record.
I think you're right on that, but I'm not certain that any change is forthcoming on that. When the individual is arrested, the data goes into the BCA's computer anyhow, and it certainly is retained by the local police agencies. And so then when I, as a defendant, get through and acquitted, they can ask and receive an expungement from the court, but there's nothing in there that's going to take and pull that back that's been out on the street and everybody and has access to that, is I guess what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, I believe you're referring to just data that's out in the public sphere because of the internet access, and it's out there third parties are collecting it. Is that what you're referring to? I agree with you. I think once a person has received an expungement, they can go to those data collectors and say this has been expunged and you shouldn't be reporting it, as difficult as that might be.
Sarah Betzel.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I've actually worked on legislation to deal with that very issue now, and because, in fact, I authored the original expungement language in the Senate years ago, and the treatment attorneys today, and it is correct that the court's jurisdiction under a court of appeals decision ends with the courts. It can't go to BCA. So I'm pleased the Supreme Court's taken up, but we're only going to take it up within a week or so. We won't know the decision for many months. And presumably we can pass this legislation.
And, you know, after the if the Supreme Court rules, however they rule, you know, we can always come back and revisit this particular issue in light of how the court rules. So, you know, if we wait for the courts to decide things all over the place, we'll never get any legislation passed. So we might as well just proceed with this. And if we need to come back, believe it or not, the legislature's back next year. So some people may not like to appreciate that, but we will be. So,
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, does counsel know, you know, when I hear of expungements and sealing records, I can't help but think of the process Minnesota undergoes for pardoning someone with a criminal record. And that's actually a pardon board that consists of Supreme Court Chief Justice, the governor, and the attorney general. Mm-hmm. They consider whether a person is worthy of pardon. The person has to have his sentence fully commuted. And if it's in the case of a personal crime, the person has to have evidence of a crime-free life for 10 years before a pardon is granted. Property crimes, they wait 5 years. Even despite that, despite a pardon extraordinary being granted, I don't believe we seal those records entirely anyway. We allow a look back. Now, under the expungements hearings that I've heard in recent years, we keep talking of sealing records, and that's just at the hand of a district court judge. And so I'm wondering, what is the difference, and how does that compare with a pardon extraordinary process versus an expungement? And if that's true, do we limit it to maybe misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor cases, or are we? What does the expungement process in this reference deal with, and how does it contrast itself with the?
Mr. Backus, could you enlighten us on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it's been quite a long time since I really reviewed the pardon law, but one big difference as a practical matter is there are a large number of expungements under 609A or the court's inherent authority, and there's, I believe, a very small number of successful pardons. And then my understanding is that the pardon is just a more extensive remedy than the sealing of the record. Mm-hmm. So that would be my short answer, if that helps.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Backus, is my memory correct that with a pardon extraordinary that we do not seal records as a result of that, or do we?
Mr. Chair, members, I would have to look that up. I don't have that handy. I'm not sure if many members of the audience have that, but I can try to look that up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once somebody receives a pardon, if they want to have it removed from their record, they have to file for an expungement. So that's
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, in the process of just a simple expungement, let's call it that for lack of a better term, the person seeking the expungement could have their records sealed as a result of that expungement order, or does that take a separate order as well?
The meaning of an expungement is as part of the order the records are sealed. Now, there are provisions within the expungement law that for law enforcement purposes, for example, they can still access those records. Certain types of
prosecutors can.
prosecutors can access them. Certain type of jobs, if you're applying for a law enforcement position, for example, they could look open up those records.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betson.
Expungement doesn't mean they throw away the records. I mean, in fact, we tried, we've made a run at it, trying to use the term sealed and so forth instead of the term expungement, but there's just so many other laws and court cases tied into this. We were stuck with the word expungement, but in no way is the record cleansed. It's just closed, which means if it was closed, it could also be reopened.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking of an employer that might not be an official law enforcement agent. Let's say a hospital that is in the process of its work distributes pharmaceuticals to various floors of the hospital as it's being, maybe they would want to have a look back on, would in this case a private employer be restricted on requesting information regarding a non-conviction criminal record in that case?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Senator Muad did have to leave, but she asked me if there were questions about her provisions to answer those. So so you're asking about the arrest records provision for private employers. Well, one thing to note is that there are a number – let me look at the statute here. What
page
is
– I'm referring to page 8, lines 6 through 13. I'm also thinking of, like, security guards, store detectives, things like that, they serve a private yet official capacity to protect the assets of an employer.
Yes, and if you read on Subdivision 2, use of non-conviction records for private employment, unless a criminal background investigation is specifically required or permitted by law, and there's a number of state statutes that require or permit an employer to look at backgrounds. They include things like working with children, working with vulnerable adults, taxi drivers, bus drivers, volunteers in the schools. I have a memo with me that lists, you know, in 10-point font, it's about this long, all the different types of positions that permit or require a background check, and those would all be exempted from this provision.
Mr. Chair, is it too hard to imagine that we might have a whole number of employers coming to the legislature sometime in the near future asking for provision in law to be exempted from it? I'm not familiar with how big this list is, but you know, here we're actually putting into law that the employer can't even request information. Now, another way to say it would be maybe the person applying for whatever employment, maybe they could simply have the protective status to say no. But is there a consequence if the employer happened to ask? In law, you're saying they must not request information.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Not convictions. These are arrest records or, you know, things that did not lead to a conviction. You know, it's pretty common, I think, if you go to a loud party where maybe somebody shot off a gun, you know, that somebody might just scoop up everybody that's there and, you know, take them down to jail. And somebody might actually, you know, be charged. But everybody else, when they find out that they, you know, that they aren't part of what went wrong, they would be released. But they would still be on the police record. Their names would be there. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, somebody shouldn't have to base an employment decision on, you know, whether you happen to be at the wrong place when some damn fool, excuse me, some person committed something wrong, but you had nothing to do with it, but you were scooped up and taken to jail anyway. It's those kinds of things. We don't want anybody to not have the information they need to make a good decision. And, you know, those kinds of things should include the, you know, conviction data. But if there's a record there that didn't lead to a conviction, then we're saying that their decision shouldn't be based
Chair, if I was an employer and happened to have a job applicant in front of me and I happened to say, looking at a resume and saying, hey, have you had any trouble with the law? Am I restricted from asking that question in this, under this parameter?
I would only mention that this, you're talking about policy issues. This is a finance division, and I prefer that you take that up someplace else. But we still have the previous amendment that... Mr. Baucus.
Mr. Chair, members, I've spoken to Senator Limmer. There's a sentence in the provision now that Mr. Foster pointed out that addresses Senator Limmer's issue, so I don't think you need to amend it.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, since this is a fiscal division, we should at least mention the appropriation.
I did. I didn't talk about it much, but I mentioned it.
First of all, this is my mistake. On page 14, line 17, the appropriation is made to the Supreme Court. I'm just told that it should be the district court, so I would suggest that you strike Supreme Court and insert district courts.
You have the... As a motion,
Mr. Chair, I'll move that on page 14, line 17, delete Supreme Court and insert district courts.
Right. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion prevails. Mr. Turman.
Mr. Chairman, members, and I'm just going to quickly go over the fiscal notes. And the procedure the revenue that comes in from the civil court filing fee is the same as the original fiscal note, $1,200,000 per year. We can only appropriate, the division can only appropriate that revenue. We've got $1.2 million. Mr. Baucus and I made a guesstimate before the fiscal note came in, and we appropriated $110,000 to DPS and $1,090,000 to the courts, which does come out to $1.2 million. According to the fiscal note, we need $1,326,000. The fiscal notes are advisory; these are based on, you know, assumptions that have no collection history. So, you know, I think it's amazing that we're as close as we are. But we will have to, I'll speak with you, Senator Higgins, come up with a proportion on the appropriations that will come out to $1.2 million that you feel comfortable with. And we'll do that. And we can do it now or we can do it in Finance Committee.
If you're ready to advise us on it, yes, we'll do it here. Sorry, Mr. Chair, I forgot to go through you.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Proceed.
It's a judgment call. I mean, right now we've got $1,090,000 going to the courts and $110,000 going to the BCA. The DPS came in and said that their cost would be $166,000. So if you wanted to fully fund the DPS, it would be $166,000. The courts would be $1,034,000. That would be one way. Now, the other thing is, this bill has to balance because to get out of Senator Cohen's committee. Now, but we can't help but talk about this bill in conjunction with your supplemental bill. And as it stands right now, the Senate bill cuts the district courts $3.5 million and the BCA by $1.8 million. So, you know, that could be considered, or it should be considered. The difference between revenues and expenditures in this bill is budget dust, pretty much, compared to that. But it does have to come out of Senator Cohen's committee at $1.2 million on both sides of the ledger.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the fiscal notes are considered advisory, although, you know, we try to get as close as we can to them. And the fiscal note even says, or the EBO comment says that, you know, everything's kind of uncertain about the money coming in and what it will actually cost. And so I think if the amount that's proportional in our existing bill is if the amounts that are in there are proportional to the revised fiscal note, I think, you know, we could stay with this amount or we could I mean, they're both in bad they're going to be in bad shape by the time we get done. So we can't make them whole, but I'm okay doing either giving public safety all they want and then shorting the courts, but I think what we've done here is kind of, shorted them both a little. And so I think we're okay leaving the language, the numbers that are in the bill as we are. Mr. Turner, did I?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
That's okay? Yes. Is that bad advice?
No. It depends on what's,
I want more.
Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah.
I want more money.
It's one of those push-me-pull-you things.
I will say that the DPS, the DPS estimate does have more of a history to it, and they've got it broken down to programming costs and one staff member, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that the court cut is going to be a great there'll be a lot of discussion about that going through the conference committee, and I would suggest giving the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension 166, shorting the courts accordingly, and then remembering that when you negotiate with Representative Paymar on the courts. That would be my recommendation.
All right. Well, if members are okay with that, I'd be happy to do that. I'm only the first time as a division chair, so I haven't figured all this stuff out yet.
Is
but I appreciate the advice from
everyone satisfied with that, Senator Limmer.
Is there a proportionality of what this short or this cut represents to these agencies? Is the 3.5 on a percentage scale, is it large or small compared to the 1.8 to the DPS?
Actually, I've got that in here somewhere. But
they were both cut about 2%.
It's about 2%, right? Both of them, yeah.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I think on line 14.17, I'll delete 1,090,000 and insert 1,034,000. And 14.19, delete 110,000 and insert 166,000. Please.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of like asking which child do you love?
Yeah, exactly.
And, both agencies have dire needs, and I find it difficult to determine which one should get it. I know that historically both of these agencies have suffered losses and they haven't had increases proportional to their workload that's coming up. So I guess I'll just follow the author's lead on it. I've kind of been watching the courts lately for the past few years, and they're getting to the point that I think some of them are beginning to close some of their extended hours, some of their divisions. They limit hours, especially in Hennepin County. And one of these days we're going to get the order that says you have to release somebody out of the jails because they won't be able to have a speedy trial based on the request of the defendant. And we've got to get a hold of the court costs, but I don't know which way to decide on this one, but I know we're fast rushing toward that cliff, and one of these days it's going to happen.
Well, that's where the problem arises, is that we're trying to solve a problem that clearly requires more money, and the potentials for loss in the court are extremely high. It's getting to the point where are we going to have any justice at all? I think we have one of the finest court systems in the country, more than concerned about the trend that we're doing. And I say that even though I spent many years, I was one of the founders of the Department of Public Safety. Look at that, and here we are, and we want something, but we don't want to pay for it. And so what are your thoughts? Senator Betzel?
Well, Mr. Chair, I moved to amend those two numbers on page 14. So that's before us.
Discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor, indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Nay.